Welcome back to Coast, where David Politis, as we talk about his latest work, Missing 411 Hunters. We'll get into some specific cases. They will chill you. Trust me. Welcome back. Missing 411 Hunters, David Politis with us. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And also, David, I would recommend, I think you would too, that for people who haven't yet started the 411 series, it's kind of good to read it chronologically. Not important, not critical, but it makes more sense if they do it that way, doesn't it?
You know, I started off with the Eastern and Western U.S. books, and I usually tell people to start with one of those and then kind of move forward in the series. And if you wanted to jump around, it wouldn't be a big deal. The only thing I do say is do not buy the books at Amazon. I don't sell through Amazon, and you're going to see them for 3 and 4 times the price of what we charge on our website. And those are resellers just trying to rip people off, so don't buy it at Amazon.
Okay, you got it there. Now let's talk about some specific cases, David. I'll let you pick them. Obviously, you know them better than anyone, and we'll go through it. Go ahead with your first case.
Well, one of the things that has always bothered me is the older hunter who goes into an area with his relatives and friends, and he disappears. And a 79-year-old guy named Fortunato Rivera, this is out of Maine, November 13th, 93, at 10 o'clock, he goes into an area near Corinth and a place called Hunt Lake. And he went in there with his son and his grandson, and his son had owned this property for quite a while, had taken his dad there before. And he put his dad into a hunting blind not far from where he and his other son were at. They were all residents of New Jersey. They had driven up the night before. And after the son walked Fortunato into the hunting stand, he said, "Hey, I'll be back in 30 minutes for you just to check on you." The guy wasn't real mobile, old, decrepit, knew exactly where he was going to stay. Well, his son left. Again, he wasn't gone long. He comes back, and his dad was gone.
Poof.
And so the son goes and gets the father's grandson, comes back, and they start screaming for their grandpa, Fortunato. And they're not hearing anything. They don't see anything. There's no tracks. So they search for a few hours. They give up. They call in search and rescue, and they bring in the Maine Warden Service. Well, they find nothing the following day, and they searched all day. They brought in canines. They weren't finding any scent. The following day, on a Monday, the searchers find Fortunato's body face up in a shallow reservoir 20 feet from shore.
Jeez.
He was not wearing his coat, shirt, or boots. This is in mid-November. And he had to have climbed over a small mountain through a boulder-strewn area to even get to that location. A ranger stated that he had to have walked at least 2 miles. The coroner stated that he died of hypothermia and a heart attack. Well, he walked in the opposite direction of where his son walked him into. This was in the middle of November. It was cold. And in my past book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence, I explained in detail the death of people, men and women, and how their body reacts in water. And a man's body, 99.9% of the time, if you die in water, you'll die face down. Fortunato was face up.
Face up, looking up toward the sky.
Very, very strange. He wasn't mobile, and his son had a problem with this, as did the warden service, about how he went to that area, how he got there, why he went there, how he ended up in the water, why he would have taken off his boots. None of it made any sense at all.
Just 79 years old. He was okay when he was there, right? It's not like he got dementia all of a sudden.
No.
Mm.
And he was seated in a seat. His son had said he'd be back with him within 30 minutes. And within that period of time, he disappeared, hiked 2 miles, and he was elderly and semi-decrepit. How does that happen?
And how did they think he died?
They're saying that he died of hypothermia and a heart attack.
Oh.
Now, I will say this, that in past books, I've coined a phrase from a New York detective, and that is local reports for local consumption. And what this detective meant, and I think it's perfect, is that in order to soothe the concerns of a local community, a coroner will sometimes come in with a verdict that really can't be substantiated. And what I found was, in a lot of these cases where the family went out and got a second opinion, it was 180 degrees from what that coroner said the first time. And to get a second opinion on a coroner usually costs between $2,000 and $5,000, so it's a wealthy thing to do. And a lot of people can't afford it, but the vast majority of the time, the decision on the cause of death is polar opposite of what the local coroner says.
All right, give us another case, David.
Well, let's stay in Maine for the time being. A place called Garfield Plantation. Again, we're going to talk about a 70-year-old man.
70, another Robert. Person up there in age, okay.
Yep, Robert Smith. This is in far northern Maine, south of Portage Lake, kind of adjacent to the Machias or Machias River. This guy was a super experienced deer hunter. He had just had cancer, went through all the recovery, doctor gave him a clean bill of health, and he was excited because he got the okay from the doctor to go hunting with his three brothers and his wife. And this was in a hunting camp that they had owned for decades on the outskirts of Garfield, Maine.
So he was all excited about this trip.
Absolutely. First time he was getting out and felt good, and he was with his family. This was November 18th, 97. Robert's wife walked with him to the hunting stand, and his brothers went to their hunting stand, and everyone got into them, and the wife was sitting in it with Robert.
Were they all relatively close in proximity?
They were within gunshot range of hearing each other.
All right.
Well, at 2:30 p.m., they hadn't seen any deer. They hadn't seen anything, which was unusual for that area. And Robert told his wife he was going to walk a half circle in the area to see what he could stir up. So he climbed down the tree. He was carrying his rifle and wearing a bright orange vest. Well, at about 5 o'clock, it was starting to get dark, and Mrs. Smith started to get worried because he hadn't come back. And she walked over to the nearby deer stand to get the other brothers to start looking for Robert. Well, by 6 o'clock, they couldn't find him, and they called the warden service. Now, George, these are the facts of what happened. There was a 9-day search, 18,000 acres, 250 wardens responded, searched along with professional law enforcement. National Guard units came in, 2 planes searched with FLIR, 2 helicopters searched with FLIR.
Jeez.
There were multiple canine teams that came in. And this is an odd one. The Naval Evasion School sent 20 personnel to assist.
Why?
Very interesting. The Naval Evasion School is attached to one of my stories regarding a lady named Geraldine Margay that disappeared on the Appalachian Trail in Maine 2 years ago. She was found on their property dead, even though that property had been searched. There's a side story to that Naval Evasion School I could talk for hours about.
Okay.
But during the search, fog and snow hit the search area multiple days and slowed the efforts. On November 24th, 97, or 6 days after Robert disappeared, the most senior game warden on the scene made this statement. He said, "This case has us totally baffled." Well, they continued to search on for weeks. The family paid for extra searchers to come in. 1 year after Robert vanished, his family went back again with another large contingent of family members and private searchers and found nothing.
A year later,
hoping to find something. Well, Robert owned the property for decades and knew it like you and I know our backyards.
And he had a rifle when he went out there, right?
Had a rifle and was wearing a bright orange vest.
Oh, my gosh.
He was never found. And why wouldn't you at least find the vest? Now, this area of northern Maine also contains a story that I wrote about where 2 Maine wardens disappeared in the early 1900s under very unusual circumstances. We won't go into the story today, but this area of northern Maine, right near the Canadian border, there's a lot of weird stuff that goes on, and this family never got closure. But this is one of those stories that isn't so abnormal. But where could this man who just got over cancer, how far could he walk?
Not too far, you would think.
No.
And just gone.
Why couldn't canines pick up a scent?
Do the canines ever act as if they're frightened?
You know, in past books, I've written strange behavior by dogs that have been brought in. Sometimes they'll walk in a circle around the handler and just lay down at the trailhead, which is really odd behavior. Other times they'll walk up the trail 20 or 30 feet and turn around and walk back. And animal behavior is a little difficult, and it's hard to tell if they're uninterested, if they're scared, or what the story is, but there is a lot of unusual behavior that goes with these stories.
Well, there sure is. Okay. Well, that's important, too, because they generally sense things. Let's get back to that Naval Evasion School for a moment.
Sure.
What do you think's going on with that? 20 people to assist? That's weird.
It's a little odd. In that they have, first of all, a lot of people don't know this, but the Navy has a school in the middle of the woods in Maine. It's called the Naval Evasion School.
Is it like a SEAL training school?
It's a lot of secrecy that goes on about behind what they really do there. But the only reason I know about it is that a woman named Geraldine Margay was hiking the Appalachian Trail, was on the last couple hundred miles of her trip that was several thousand miles up the trail, and she would hike during the day and she would meet her husband at night at various spots. Well, she disappeared on the trail and nobody could believe it because she was so consistent, so precise, never made mistakes. Well, up abutting the Appalachian Trail is this Naval Evasion School, and it's fenced, there's huge signs, stay out, blah, blah, blah. Well, somehow or another, Geraldine got off the trail and got several hundred feet into the Naval Evasion School. Now, they did allow the Maine Warden Service to come in and search as long as they were with someone from their school. And Maine said that they did search it, and they didn't see anything. Now, 2 years later, Geraldine's found in a small tent deceased on the Naval Evasion School property. Nobody can believe, number one, she wasn't found. Number two, why she would stay there and not come back to the trailhead. None of it made any sense at all. And the reports about it are completely baffling.
Any cause of death on this one?
You know, I've waited a year and a half and I haven't seen one yet.
Nothing yet. Any more cases in Maine, David, or should we move to another state?
Let's go to the West Coast. Let's go to Oregon.
Let's go to Oregon.
This is a fascinating case because I actually got to talk to the deputy that investigated it. This case involves a man named Robert Winters, another older man, 78 years old, missing October 8th, 69 in Sparks Lake, about 2 miles northwest of Mount Bachelor and a quarter mile southeast of Devil's Lake. People that know my work know that I've made a comparison of where people disappear with the name Devil.
Oh, that's
and it's a strange coincidence.
Yeah.
And in one book, there's a couple hundred of these cases. Well, Robert was also hunting with his three sons, and he hunted this exact area up from Spark Lakes for 20 years.
20 years. So he knew it like the back of his hand.
Absolutely. Well, the men went into the area and just as would be normal, at about 11 o'clock, they split up, and they agreed to meet back that afternoon. Robert never came back, and as it got dark, the snow started to fall. And one of the profile points I write about in my books is a weather change in conjunction with a disappearance. Well, his boys contacted the Deschutes County Sheriff, and as the night went on, the snow got heavier and heavier. Well, the next day, they brought in 60 searchers. They converged on the area they knew Robert would be at. And they put a helo up, and the helicopter reported spotting some kind of tracks at 7,100 feet. But they were discounted as being too high for those to be Robert. He wouldn't go that high. He was too old.
Mm-hmm.
He just wouldn't climb that high.
He couldn't breathe up that high.
No. So after utilizing helicopters, professional search and rescue, 5 days, the decision was made to terminate the search effort. Now, fast forward 9 months, and a Dr. Jack Crosby of Bend was camping near Soda Creek, and he found a deer rifle leaning against a tree, along with some glasses, clothing, and other items. And he knew it didn't look right, and he contacted the sheriff. Well, one of the guys that went out there, they sent two deputies out for a week, and this guy's name was Deputy Thrasher, one of the investigators on the case. And he said, Dave, he goes, we went out there and we were expecting to find a body, and we kind of knew it was going to be Robert. But he goes, what we went out there is we saw the strangest thing I've ever seen in my career. And he said he's investigated over 50 deaths in the woods over his career. He's never seen anything like this. He said that they went out and they found one boot, one glove, glasses that were intact, and a few other personal items. He says the deputy spent 3 days searching a radius going outward up to 150 feet. And he said that it was his opinion and his other deputy's opinion that the clothes were removed from the body because of the way they were unbuttoned. Mm-hmm. They weren't torn. Nothing was chewed on. No bones were ever found. There was never a sign of death. He stated that the scene was like something out of a movie. And he says it was almost as though something was challenging him to try to figure out what happened. He says he's never investigated a scene where everything was gone. He says there was no big bones, small bones, little bones. There was no scat in the area. I asked him if he had an explanation for why his clothes were on the ground and there was no body. He said, Dave, there's no explanation.
Were they neatly tucked away there on the ground or just scattered?
Scattered. And then I asked him, I said, well, usually you always find boots in proximity where the body would have been because animals just don't carry away boots.
Right.
And boots last for decades and decades. He goes, you're exactly right. He goes, where's the other boot? He goes, we only found one and we looked for days. And then the family and the wife needed a death certificate so they could sell a house and go through proceedings. And the coroner of that county refused to issue a death certificate because there was no sign of death.
Well, they may be right, I guess, huh?
Well, Thrasher said, he goes, you called me about the one case in my career I couldn't offer you one iota of what happened.
And the fact that he had investigated 50 past deaths before, that seems pretty high too, David.
It seems like a lot. And this area of Oregon and the Cascades has a lot of missing people, a lot. And just this past summer, two more people disappeared in northern Oregon in the Cascades and weren't found. It's an area that, for some reason, I have no idea why, but that region, starting at about Crater Lake in southern Oregon, going all the way up through Washington, has a ton of people that disappear.
Do people talk about these cases in these regions? Have they become like myths and legends?
You know, there was a conference in Washington a month ago, and I was at it. And it's surprising how many people know about this and come up and talk to you about it and say, hey, you know, you're really onto something, and we've known about this. It's been happening for years, and the press doesn't want to talk about it, but we all know it's happening, and there's big numbers out there of these people that are happening, and nobody really wants to address it. And he goes, A lot of people said I'm the first person who's ever wanted to discuss.
You probably are. We're going to come back with more of these case studies, and then, of course, I'm going to ask you some various scenarios and see what you think. We'll be back. We're going to take your phone calls with David Politis next hour as we talk about his latest work, Missing 411 Hunters. And welcome back to Coast, David Politis with us. David, let's get back into some more of these cases, some of your favorites that you've got illustrated in Missing 411 Hunters. What's next for us?
Well, let's go to Virginia and talk about a 41-year-old man named Eric Smith. November 8th, 2013, 10 o'clock, he lived in Cedar Bluff. He was a general mine foreman for Consol Energy, and he owned 40 acres on the outskirts of town. Well, in the early morning hours of November 8th, Eric told his wife that he was going to go out and hunt the property behind the house. And interesting part about this is that he also complained to his wife earlier that morning that he had flu-like symptoms just before he left for the hunt.
Okay.
And we talked about that briefly, but I'm suspecting that this happens more than it's even reported, because many times in a report, they may not have the subtleties of this. But in this case, his wife talked about it. And he took his rifle, went out into the property behind the house. He never came back. And again, it's his backyard. He walked it probably 100 times or more. And the Tazewell County Sheriff and the Virginia State Police orchestrated the search. 8 different bloodhound teams went into the area. They never picked up a scent. Hundreds of friends and private searchers left Consol Energy and assisted in the search. In total, there were 6 days, and they found nothing. Another interesting part to this is that Eric only had one eye, and he lost an eye at work years earlier. And one of the things I've written about in other books is that many of the victims have some type of either hidden or obvious disability. Sometimes it's as simple as, well, maybe they have diabetes, dementia, autism, maybe they lost an eye. They have some kind of medical issue that sometimes isn't obvious. Well, in Eric's case, it was obvious. Now, this happened 3 years ago. He's never been found.
Jeez. And when you say it's obvious in some cases about their condition and others don't, it seems that the great majority of these individuals, something's wrong with them physically.
I think in Eric's case, it was pretty obvious. He was complaining that he was sick. So something happened. I mean, he was ill, something. But in a lot of these cases, specifically about hunters, there's this communication amongst them where they tell each other, I don't feel well. I'm going to go back to camp.
So they go back alone, right?
Right.
And they're just not found. Do they ever get to the camp?
The best they can tell is, probably not. It's somewhere in that journey between where they split up and where they're supposed to arrive back that they just don't.
Just doesn't make sense. You had a story of someone who saw something like the predator. You know, one of those wavy type beings, whatever they were. Which one was that?
So, this is the first time I've ever written about something like this, and I try to keep it pretty confined to the story at hand. In this instance, the informant, the person that was involved, was just beyond reproach credible. And it was a bow hunter, and the husband was a man named Bruce McAbee, and I'm sure you know Bruce.
I know Bruce.
And he was an optical physicist for the U.S. Navy. Bruce has actually given briefings to the CIA before on ultra-terrestrial and UFOs.
He's amazing.
He's probably the most credible investigator I personally know of in North America. He's absolutely impeccable. I brought a lot of things to him in the past and asked for an analysis on it, and he's always really, really amiable to do it. Well, anyhow, he's married, and his wife's name is Jan. Well, on September 29th, 2010, they live on the outskirts of Lima, Ohio, kind of in the middle of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And they have woods just outside their property where they have a hunting blind. And Jan took a trip into the woods behind her house. And 1 mile north of where her hunting blind is Shawnee High School. That's just something to keep in the back of your mind.
Okay.
Well, Jan got into the blind at about 5:30. She started texting a friend. And at 6:21, she took a few photos with her handheld phone. And she said that all of a sudden, everything goes silent. She said there were no more birds chirping, no more squirrels, no more rustling of the wind, nothing. And she goes, she knew something was up. And she thought maybe some type of predator was coming towards her. She was bow. She was in her stand, had the bow in her hand, had the phone in her hand. Well, about 15 to 20 feet in front of her at some other trees across the trail, She said she saw some type of distortion in the trees, up in the tree, almost parallel to where she was in height. And she said it reminded of looking through saran wrap at something.
A wavy saran wrap.
Right. And she had her BlackBerry in her right hand, and she wasn't sure, but she thought she took a picture. And she goes, I was shaken by what I was looking at, because to me it was something that was alive, that was moving point to point.
Wow.
And she said it stayed there for several seconds, and then it moved on. And she goes, I was too afraid to move for 90 minutes. I just stayed in my stand. And Bruce and her were having some dinner guests, so she climbed out of her stand and just made a beeline home. And she said after dinner, she goes, I didn't want to say anything in front of everybody to Bruce, but after dinner, she checked Facebook. And her nephew was in the band at Shawnee High School, and he left a note on Facebook that the band was practicing that night on the field and saw a huge bright light above their field. He said it got progressively smaller, and then it reappeared. And it all happened between 7:50 and 8 o'clock, which would have been the time that Jan was in the stand. Well, she now remembered that she hadn't told Bruce about her sighting, and she told him about it. And the following day, they sat together, and they reviewed the photo on her phone. And they found one blurry photo that almost appears to be a blurred picture with almost a DNA strand along the left side. Well, Bruce took the photo to Verizon Technical Services. This is where Bruce's expertise comes in.
That's right, and he's sharp.
Super sharp, especially on optics. And they stated that the phone took the photo, but it was impossible for that phone to take that photo based on the pixelization and the physical construction of the photo. So Bruce goes, I know it doesn't make sense. They confirmed that the photo was taken by the phone, but to the best of their knowledge, their phone couldn't take that photo on the way it was set up. It
makes no sense, does it?
No. And Bruce tested all the possibilities that could have possibly made the photo, and he said nothing makes sense. He goes, obviously, Jan didn't take a photo of herself. It was taken straight away. And when she described what she saw to Bruce, he goes, Jan, I know what you saw. And he gets out the movie Predator, he puts it in his VCR, and he plays it, and Jan goes, oh my gosh.
That's it.
That's it. And then if you couple that with the nephew's observation in the sky just a mile from her stand, in essentially the same time frame, the photo confirmed something really, really unusual happened out there. And then the camera supposedly couldn't take the photo, but did. And then the last thing I'll put in here is that I've written a lot about the Great Lakes, and there's a great book out there called The Great Lakes Triangle, if you can get a hold of it. It's hard to find. It's old, and it's out of print. But it talks about a minutia of data on things that have happened around the Great Lakes, missing people, missing planes, odd disappearances, strange disappearances of huge ships. And Lima is not that far from the Great Lakes, and it just kind of goes to that area out there that something unusual has happened over the years. And I wouldn't even have put this in the book, except that there's corroboration that something happened. Bruce validated it. The nephew corroborates that something happened strange at the same time. Who knows what happened out there?
So let me ask you a few scenarios, and let's go through them, and just give me your opinion on things. Let's talk with the obvious. And the obvious is people go wandering into the wilderness, and the weather conditions get them, and they die. Doesn't explain why they're not found, but what about that? Is that possibility?
I think search and rescue people would say, no, that isn't what's happening, if they were honest. And because when they bring in professional trackers, a tracker can track somebody across anything, through anything, and they're not finding the people.
Right. A dog will find somebody.
Exactly. And when they bring in multiple dogs, maybe one dog doesn't want to work that day, but multiple dogs, I don't believe that.
A serial killer, some sicko, is out there hiding, grabbing people whenever he or she can.
And that's brought up a lot by people who haven't read the books. But I live in Colorado. and I'll use this as an example, Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana, the vast majority of hikers here carry guns. And if that happened, there'd be a shootout on the trail. And you have a big problem out there if you want to abduct somebody on the trail and they don't want to go. How do you force them to go? Let's say you shoot them, dead weight, that's hard to carry a body at elevation anywhere. And then how do you dispose of the body? Well, they bring in cadaver dogs on these cases, and the cadaver's not found. And none of these people have ever really been found in a quote-unquote grave. So that scenario doesn't make sense either.
So wild animals are out there, and they grab people. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, these wild animals would make wild sounds, or people would scream. If some animal was grabbed onto your leg, you're going to scream about it. People don't hear that. But the wild animal theory, what do you think of that?
So another scenario that's brought up quite a bit, and let's just say the mountain lion scenario. If a mountain lion attacks you, yeah, you're going to scream. You're going to fight for your life. There's going to be almost a crime scene there where this happens. There's going to be blood. There's going to be hair. There's going to be clothing. And then the final thing is, if the mountain lion's successful, there's going to be drag marks away from the scene where they take the body.
That's right.
And they cache it. And the reality of that is that search and rescue goes out and vets all this at the start of the search. They look for mountain lion tracks, bear tracks, predator tracks. They look for these kind of drag marks, and if they find them, then that changes the entire complexion of the search. So this is vetted at the very beginning of all search and rescues.
Let's get into now some of the stranger possibilities. Somebody's walking and stumbles into a vortex to another dimension or another world that is opened up, maybe for a short time. But they just seem to just wander right into it. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. What about that?
I've heard this scenario before, and again, I'm not an expert in it. But I will tell you that in these groups of people that I've written about where one person disappears in a small sliver of time when there's the opportunity that they're alone, it almost appears as though they're targeted, and it's not accidental. Because the time frame of them disappearing is so minimal. And other people have commented who have read the books, it's almost like the opportunity presents itself and something jumps on it and takes it. And under the vortex scenario, again, I'm not an expert, but it's like you said, you kind of walk into it and you disappear. Well, if that was the case, then a group of people should walk into it and disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Or people on a trail should see somebody disappear.
Right.
And I've never heard that.
All right. Next would be some kind of ET intervention where maybe they're just quickly beamed aboard a craft and they're gone.
What could I say to that? I don't know how to overcome that. I suppose that would be the optimum circumstance.
It would be. It's quick, silent. And they're gone.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't explain why some of the clothes comes back, one shoe. That's weird all by itself.
Yeah, and if someone was gonna make the effort and drop clothing and shoes off at a location, then where would the body be, and why wouldn't there be other evidence that they were there?
How about a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot grabbing people?
Well, again,
that's almost like the wild animal theory, though.
Again, I think that you could find tracks. I've read people find Sasquatch, Bigfoot tracks out in the wild. They're casted all the time. I think that they have. I've read that they have a distinct smell, so I think that would be something else that the dogs would key on. And again, like you've said, George, if a small boy was grabbed by one, I think that kid would yell.
I would think so. Whatever's happening, David, it's not a very friendly, benevolent thing. Would you agree with that?
I don't think it's good for us, George.
No. This is scary. This is tragic. This is not fun and games for the individual who disappears. It's not like he's going to show up 5 years from now and all is well, talking about his planetary trip. There's something very evil about this.
Well, as many people have commented in the past, you know, our government has been known to not admit anything that they can't control and can't kill. And everything points to whatever this is, they can't control it, and they sure as hell can't catch it or kill it.
And why state parks or forests? Why the wilderness like that?
Well, in one sense, U.S. forests and national parks, the jurisdiction there is the federal government. And if something happens inside of a national park, primary jurisdiction goes to the national park police. And then if there's secondary involvement, it goes to federal investigators. Now, the National Park Service has a series of special agents assigned to their parks that are detectives. Now, if it goes beyond them, then they call on the FBI. Now, there have been instances that I've written about, specifically at Crater Lake, where a young guy, a 19-year-old kid, disappeared next to the lake. And a year later, this is in the middle of winter with 20-foot drifts of snow. 8-9 months later, his body is found 12 miles into the wilderness in this small box canyon.
12 miles. Wow.
12 miles. The ranger, I got to interview him personally, said, "Dave, we talked about this for months. There's no way that kid got from point A to point B in the middle of winter."
There you are. I almost lost you for a moment.
And he said that they walked into the scene. They knew something was really wrong. They backed out. They called for an FBI evidence response team out of Portland, and they came down and they worked that scene. And what the scene was, is they stepped over a Douglas fir tree and looked down, and they saw a pair of socks at the bottom of a pair of jeans. The jeans were unbuckled.
Oh.
They were unzipped, and there was a broken tibia in the right leg of the jeans. There were small bones in the socks, and that was it.
My God.
There were no boots. They never found the boots.
Just ripped right out of his jeans.
Well, the weird thing was is that the jeans were, you know, unbuttoned and undone. And he goes, it was just a completely wrong scenario. He says, everything we tried to make sense of it, he said, it made no sense.
And how do you explain the bones?
He said he couldn't. And he goes, that's the reason that we said there's no way we're touching this scene. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request against the FBI for a copy of their report. And, George, it looked like something out of the X-Files. 80% of it was redacted
and blacked out.
Right.
We're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls with you, David, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll also talk a few more cases. This is really weird stuff, folks.